Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I am joined tonight by our Ethics Talk regulars, Nick and Mike. And also on the line with us are three very special guests, Pamela Yates, Paco de Onis, and Alejandro de Onis. They're all of Skylight Pictures. And tonight's show is called Norm Entrepreneurs, The Journey of the Creative Minds Behind Skylight Pictures. And what we'll be doing in tonight's show is focusing on the journeys of these three incredible individuals and how they become, we sort of coined a term tonight, human rights entrepreneurs. It's different from norm entrepreneurs. The show, I should mention, is sort of a preview show for visit by Paco to Central Michigan University this week. He will be visiting and giving lectures on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. If you are in the area, you can come to those events. They're free and open to the public. HumanRightsMonth.com is where you get all the information. And if you're not in the area, these events will be streamed live. You can watch on live stream. If you can participate live, or if you cannot, you can watch via the archives. So, first, I just want to make a clarification about this term norm entrepreneur before we get started talking to Pamela. And the term norm entrepreneur really refers to somebody whose mission, or it could be a person or an organization, whose mission it is to change existing norms. It's different from a social entrepreneur, and Mike, you were explaining, I think, quite clearly the difference. So can you, for the audience, explain the difference between norm and social entrepreneur?
As succinctly as possible. When I think of a social entrepreneur, I think of a single issue, person or society, or maybe multiple issue, person or organization. An example would be people involved in Darfur now. They're very interested in the genocide going on in Darfur, but that's about it. And not to minimize them, not to minimize the work they're doing, just a different category of social interest, I guess.
Right. And so, you know, other examples of social entrepreneurs are typically nonprofits like Lyft or Strongmen, Strong Girls. They've been on this show before. And they're trying to exist in, or address an existing problem. Norm entrepreneurs aren't doing that, but I think that their efforts are broader and they're trying to actually change attitudes and norms and the normative commitments of society, ultimately, I would imagine, through policy. And I see Skylight Pictures as doing that. I also want to say that, and Pamela, I believe you're really the original creator of Skylight Pictures, along with Peter Kanoy, is that correct?
That's correct.
And Skylight has been around for about 25 years, is that correct?
25-plus years, yes.
25-plus years, wow. And I want to say that, you know, we're really starting, you know, backwards here, because how I came to know about Skylight is through your latest film, The Reckoning, The Battle for the International Criminal Court, which we will be screening this week at Central Michigan University. And so Skylight, I'm sure, has been evolving, and I've seen Skylight with its work with The Reckoning and the International Criminal Court evolving into much more than a company that makes films. And I just want to say that in addition to your own personal journeys, the organization itself has been on a journey, as I see it sitting here in Michigan. And so hence this show. And I just want it to be known that we are talking about an organization and individuals who have been working on this organization for 25-plus years. So with that background, I'm going to turn it over to Mike. There you go.
I'd just like to add a quick proviso before we start. We usually encourage guest callers on the show. If you can't get in right away tonight, please be patient. We may not have time to get to everyone because we're cramming an awful lot, and we hold our guests in very high regard. So we'll be focusing on them more than guest callers. So please be patient. Don't be upset with us if we don't get to you. Now, Pamela,
yes.
I'm really uncomfortable calling you Pamela. I hope that's okay, but I feel as though you deserve a higher title than that.
Pamela,
like doctor? How about doctor? How about honorary doctor?
I'd really like to call you Dr. Yates. That's my my intuition, but if Pamela is what you prefer, Pamela is what I'll go with.
That's fine.
Okay. I have a quick question for you. I don't know when the last time you looked at your Wikipedia page, but according to that page, you were born and raised in the Appalachian coal mining region of Pennsylvania, and you ran away from home when you were 15. Is that true? I mean, I didn't hunt down the source that was used or anything. I just thought that was really odd.
That's true. I grew up in a small town near Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is in the northernmost coal valley in Pennsylvania, where anthracite coal was mined for decades and decades and decades. And when I came of age, really, that area of the country was suffering tremendously. There were no jobs. And I was a very restless young woman, and I had dreamed about how I was going to get out and be part of the larger world since about the time I was 12. So by the time I was 15, I figured out how to do it, and I did it. And, you know, we used to listen to the New York City radio stations on our transistor radios under our blankets at night, because like at 2 or 3 in the morning, you could actually get the New York City stations. So when I ran away from home, I ran away to the scariest and most dangerous place I could think about, which was New York City.
Wow. So at 12 years old, I mean, this isn't exactly what you said, but it just seems so unbelievable to me. You knew at 12 years old that you wanted to change societies?
I knew at 12 years old that I wanted to be part of this big social movement that was beginning to make changes. And that was the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the movement to end the war in Vietnam. These were things that were part of the world when I was coming of age, and I didn't want to be in my town of 2,000 people. I wanted to be part of that. So that was part of wanting to get out of town. Also, I had a terrible high school. I wasn't engaged in school. So I'm telling you this, but I'm not recommending it to any of the readers out there. Each of us find our own paths, and we don't want to create chaos and mayhem in our own family. But this was just my path.
Sure, and I'm still having a hard time gripping this. I think at 12 years old, I was interested in, like, Pokemon and flag football. You know, I don't think I had any idea what was going on outside of the town I lived in. Just incredible.
Yeah, so what compelled you to, I mean, like, you know, be involved with these issues, or were you just always naturally interested in investigating these sorts of questions about Vietnam War and different movements that were going on within the States?
Well, it really starts out with something much more basic than that, which is in the Lackawanna Coal Valley of northeastern Pennsylvania, storytelling is very big. How good a story you could tell was your currency. And really, the people of my parents' generation were so good at it. My father was an excellent storyteller, a real raconteur. And it was, even though it was a poor part of the country, we had this rich culture. And so it was really storytelling and what we should, and what we can tell stories about and how we can tell stories that move one another, that was more my basis. And that is what eventually I translated into telling stories that I thought should be heard, stories from people who seem to have no voice in the larger society, poor people and coal miners and people left out of the great American dream and people who wanted to change society and people who were really heroes in their own right but may not have been known. So it was really the combination of storytelling plus the social change that was roiling the country that set me on the road to becoming a human rights filmmaker.
I'm curious a little bit more about the culture of this storytelling. So was it like the community, basically, let's say you walk into the general store, you know, are you going to hear a story from the clerk, or is it common that storytelling just kind of stays within family and friends, or does it kind of take on a different realm and being more broad than just the family?
Oh, no, it's pretty much everyone, but it's not, we don't think of them as stories, we just think of it as talking, but it's the way you talk and how long your stories are and how much humor you're able to infuse in them that make you a good storyteller or not.
Sure, I can see that. So let me ask you, I mean, unless anybody else wants to backtrack into your childhood more, you're 15 years old, you've run away to New York, now what?
I had one friend in high school who'd gotten a scholarship to go to college in New York City, so I went and slept on her luggage shelf for a while. It didn't need very much. Those were minimal days. I much prefer a big city, even though I grew up in a small town. Somewhere in my soul, I knew I was an urban animal. I think one of the things that gives New York City its vibrancy are all the people from small towns around America. You know, people who feel out of place in our small town but feel very much at home in New York City. So that was really why I came here. And then when I was 21 years old, I finally went to university.
How did you, if you don't mind my asking, if you don't want to answer a question, please feel free to decline. How did you make it into college, university rather?
You mean how did I get in?
How did you raise the money? I want the, all the details. Give me every nitty gritty detail.
Well, I went to the, I from New York, I actually went to Western Massachusetts. I became a resident of Western Massachusetts. I worked as a photographer for a small newspaper there in Holyoke. So I was already a state resident, and I went to the University of Massachusetts, which in those days was very, very inexpensive. And, you know, I, like so many college students, I worked as well as went to school.
Mm. Very good.
And what were you doing with working for a photographer? What was your job?
No, I was I was working for the newspaper as a photographer.
Okay, you were
I had a photographer. Yeah, in New York City, I had learned photography, and I went to Western Massachusetts because there was a migration of Puerto Ricans moving up the Connecticut Valley, and I had friends living in Western Massachusetts, and I went to work for the newspaper. While I was there, I realized nobody on the newspaper spoke Spanish, even though there were all these Spanish-speaking people in Holyoke. And so I decided to go to Mexico for 2 months to learn Spanish. I thought in 2 months I could learn Spanish. I didn't really know what it took to learn a foreign language. And I actually ended up staying for 2 years. So that was really my my baptism in Latin America and in Latin American politics and in the Latin American diaspora in the United States.
So from there to Skylight Pictures, what are we missing? I mean, what's the, can you fill in the blank for me? You've gone to Mexico
sure.
to learn Spanish, ended up staying for 2 years.
Yeah, then I came back and went to university at the University of Massachusetts, and I studied film and television production and political science. And from there, I moved back to New York City, and I started to work in film. And eventually, in 1979, Peter Kanoy and I founded Skylight Pictures. So that was really the genesis of it. I worked for many years, even at Skylight Pictures, as a sound recordist on other people's films. I had a parallel career because it's very difficult to make a living as a documentary filmmaker, especially then. It's less so now. And so I would work on many other people's films, feature films, music videos, commercials, other documentaries, as well as make my own films. And it's been about 10, 15 years now where I haven't been working as a sound recordist, but it was one of the ways that I was able to continue to be a documentary filmmaker and work in film.
In terms of,
I just want to add one thing. When you said earlier that, you know, I wanted to backtrack a little bit into Pam's childhood, there's one thing she's left out which I think is very significant because of the work that we do, and that is that Pam saw To Kill a Mockingbird when she was a young woman.
Mm.
Or how old were you, Pam? I don't know when you saw it, but you're essentially
it was the
same
first
age.
It was the first film I ever saw, and I was the same age as Scout, the young girl in the film who's just about to begin school. And really, that film completely changed how I viewed the world. Where I lived, there were no African Americans. And I found it to be a compelling story about the quest for justice.
Mm.
There you go. See, films can make a difference.
Cool.
That is an important detail. Thank you, Paco.
I can really see that as framing your life at this point.
Yeah, and it seems like, I don't know, I got this image of you, Pamela, as this very courageous person who's, you know, not afraid to really kind of, I guess, break away from whatever, you know, community you've started to become a part of and just develop somewhere else, you know, based on where your interests are. And I had a point with this, but I was thinking about, you know, becoming a, you know, an exceptional filmmaker. I was wondering, you know, does it take more experience, you know, like having those experiences and being able to kind of move to where things are interesting to you to be able to be a great filmmaker, or is there a lot more technical? Do you find it, you know, that perhaps the education was more valuable, or maybe they're both coincide together? I don't know. I was wondering if you could speak on the.
I think they're both important, but I do think that any filmmaker and any artist really has to follow their passion. So you have to go to the place that is critically important to you. You have to go to a place where you feel that maybe you can make a difference. You know, technique is something you can learn. Anybody can learn technique, but that's just where it starts. What are you going to do with the technique? How are you going to really tell a story? Thanks for the compliment about being courageous, but, you know, I find myself in many milieus where people around me are so much more courageous than I am, and that really inspires me to sort of go even further. So I really draw on the people that I make films about.
This is totally unplanned, as many of our things. This is, you know, it's sort of improvisational show, but this question that Nick asked about what it takes to make, what is the crucial ingredient in being a great filmmaker, and Pamela, your response that, you know, it's really about the artist following his or her passion. We do actually have a clip that we've played on this show before that I can play, and it's from Walk the Line. Have you guys seen that film?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I haven't, no.
Okay, well, I'm going to play this clip, and then I'm going to then ask Pamela, like, to for you to comment on it if it resonates with you in any way, and I think it's about a three-minute clip.
Yeah, we should just play this every show. It's so good.
Okay, so here comes the clip. Should I set it up? No.
Sure.
Okay. No, here it comes.
Yes, I know when Jesus saved me,
saved my soul.
The very moment he forgave me,
made me whole.
He took away my heavy burdens. Lord, he gave me peace within.
Peace within.
Well, Satan can't make me doubt it.
I won't doubt it.
It's real and I'm gonna shout it.
I'm gonna shout it.
Well, I was there with.
Hold on. I hate to interrupt, but you guys got something else. I'm sorry. I can't market gospel no more.
So that's it?
I don't record material that doesn't sell, Mr. Cash, and gospel like that doesn't sell.
So is it the gospel or the way I sing it?
Both.
Well, what's wrong with the way I sing it?
I don't believe you.
You saying I don't believe in God? JR. Come on, let's go. No. I want to understand. I mean, we come down here, we play for a minute, and he tells me I don't believe in God.
You know exactly what I'm telling you. We've already heard that song 100 times, just like that, just like how you sang it.
Well, you didn't let us bring it home.
Bring it home? All right, let's bring it home. He was hit by a truck. And you were lying out in that gutter dying, and you had time to sing one song. Huh? One song people would remember before your dirt. One song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on earth. One song that would sum you up. You telling me that's the song you'd sing? That same Jimmy Davis tune we hear on the radio all day about your peace within and how it's real and how you're going to shout it. Or would you sing something different? Something real. Something you felt. Because I'm telling you right now, that's the kind of song people want to hear. That's the kind of song that truly saves people. It ain't got nothing to do with believing in God, Mr. Cash. It has to do with believing in yourself.
Bravo.
That's the clip, Pamela.
Hallelujah.
Does that resonate with what you were getting at in answering Nick's question?
Exactly. That we don't have to do what's set out for us to do. We have to really follow our heart to do what we think we can do. And, you know, it's really amazing in filmmaking now that the democratization process and the tools that each and every one of us pretty much have at our fingertips to tell filmic stories is extraordinary. Mm. So, but that's not enough. You have to be able to tell a great story, and you have to use all of the elements of cinema, of filmmaking, to bring it together to tell that story.
Fascinating. Absolutely love to hear the... I mean, maybe this isn't an inspirational story to you, but to me it is. I mean, I find it very inspirational.
I second that.
If I can ask you one last question in summation.
Sure.
Darkest moment of Skylight. Tell us what it was and how you overcame it. The moment when it didn't look like this dream was going to happen.
You mean at its inception or during the 25-plus years?
Either or. I mean, before it started or after you'd kicked it off and it looked like it had reached its final days.
You know, or maybe you just had a smooth road the whole way, but...
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Not the case.
Well, I'll tell you our darkest moment. In the 1990s, Peter Kanoy and I made a trilogy of films called Living Broke in Boom Times, and it was about poor people and poor people's movements in the United States. Poor people who were left out of the greatest economic boom that the United States had experienced and had decided that they were not going to become beneficiaries of charity, but they were really going to empower themselves and try to understand why in the United States, the richest country in the world, was there so much poverty? Was there so much homelessness? Why did so many kids go to bed hungry every night? And so we began to make these films, and we could not get any support. All of the support that heretofore had come our way from foundations or churches or other organizations or individuals, because we had been making films about other countries, had dried up. And so we limped along in the 1990s, making these films, often with our own money, often with sweat equity from a lot of our colleagues in the documentary film arena. And I wasn't really sure we were going to be able to hold Skylight together that way. So when Paco came along and joined with Skylight Pictures, he really breathed new life into our company. And then we began to embark on this quartet of films about transitional justice. The Reckoning is the second in the quartet of films. The first one was State of Fear, about the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, about truth, The Reckoning, about justice, and we're now making a new film called Granito, which means tiny grain of sand. What is the tiny grain of sand that each of us can contribute to positive social change? And the fourth one will be about memory, called Memoryscape.
And I just want to say that going back to what you were saying, Pamela, about how the funding was scarce, and it's a nice transition because Paco is coming up next, but, and how Paco breathes new life into Skylight. But just going back to the title of the show, a norm entrepreneur, like the actual definition of an entrepreneur, and this is from Wikipedia, I have it in front of me, it is a person who assumes significant accountability for the inherent risks of the outcome. So, you know, you're basically putting out your own money and assuming the risk and so forth. And then that goes to our second person to whom we have questions. So, Mike.
This is a perfect introduction, Paco. As you pointed out to us before the show began, we were having a slight conversation. You told us you were not with Skylight at the beginning. And, you know, the panel has reiterated this fact that you joined and breathed new life into Skylight. So, how did you become a member of Skylight, and what were you doing before?
Okay, well, I'll start with how I became a member. Actually, before becoming a member of Skylight, about 10 years before, I met and shortly thereafter married Pamela. So through Pamela, actually, I got into documentary film, but not working directly with Skylight. Through meeting friends and colleagues, one of them from your state, as you all well know, Michael Moore, because of my, Pamela and Michael were good friends. Pamela had helped Michael get Roger and me out there, you know, and well, that's another long story. But in any case, Michael was about to start a show called TV Nation on NBC, and it was surprising that any network would give him a show, you know, after seeing Roger and me, but they did. And then he asked me if I wanted to be a producer on the show, and I said, I've never been a television producer. He said, that's exactly why I want you to be a producer. But I had been produced, going back to the second question, I basically feel like I've been a producer in all my life, or maybe this norm entrepreneur idea is something that I had never looked at it that way, because I didn't know the term until I heard it from Hope. But I had in my mid-20s to mid-30s, I was living in Cartagena, Colombia, and I had a restaurant to help, you know, to pay the rent. And through that restaurant, I met a lot of people. Long story short, I decided to start a music festival. I felt that living in this Caribbean town in Cartagena, the Caribbean culture of the town wasn't celebrated because of the dominance in Colombia of the Andean culture coming out of Bogota. And I thought that, that was strange, and a festival of Caribbean music coming from all over the Caribbean and Western Africa, where a lot of the Caribbean music is one of the great sources that influenced Caribbean music. We started bringing bands from all these different places every year for a four-day festival. It turned into a huge cultural change maker, I would say. The local university started having courses on Caribbean music. There were culinary festivals, you know, Caribbean cuisine, Caribbean poetry, and, you know, Caribbean. People became very aware of their ties to other parts of the Caribbean and the African diaspora. So that's one thing I was doing in Colombia. And actually, after Colombia, I moved to Miami with my family, and Alejandro had been born in Cartagena, and his sister as well, and then we moved to Miami, where I took an old rundown theater in Miami Beach when it was still kind of the Miami Beach of Miami Vice of Scarface. Things could be had so cheaply. I took this huge Art Deco theater and turned it into a cultural space, and we had hundreds of concerts and poetry readings and all kinds of cultural events for about 5 years. And because of my background in music in Colombia, Pam was commissioned to do a film about music, a pilot actually, for Benetton in the early 90s that was going to be music, you know, Colors TV, and they wanted music in unusual places, and she chose the northwest of Colombia. This is before Shakira became world-renowned, because she's from the north coast of Colombia as well. But so a lot of people said, oh, you should call this guy Paco. He has his music festival down there. And that's how we met, over music. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. It almost sounded, when you began describing your history from Colombia, as though you started helped start a cultural movement on accident. Like it just kind of happened. One thing led to another, and next thing you know, all of this Caribbean flavor is taking off.
Yeah. The festival was the spark. After that, it ran on its own. I mean, everybody looked forward to the festival every year, but activities just started going. You know, young people started making bands new sounds that they were getting from different parts of the Caribbean and Africa and mixing it up. And it was very exciting. It was a real cultural cauldron. It was great.
And then Michael Moore saw you as his proverbial Maximus Decimus Meridius. Uncorruptible.
No, but he hired Pam as a producer too. And actually, the first production job Pam and I did it together. It was a funny piece about NAFTA. We went down to the Mexican border, and it was in the first program. But yeah, no, it was. But anyway, after 10 years of working with different people in New York, from Michael Moore, I was led to a series with John Hockenberry, and then I did a series with Bill Moyers, did a bunch of stuff for something called New York Times Television, which I don't think exists anymore. But then at some point, I thought, you know, I spoke to Pam and Pamela and Peter, and said, let's really try to not have to work for other people anymore and constantly be interrupting the work we want to do, and see if we can just concentrate 100% on our films. And I decided to try to start raising money for that. And I have to say, I think I'm a pretty good fundraiser. I've raised funds for the festival in Colombia and for my space in Miami. And speaking of, Pamela talked about the passion, to follow your passion, and I think that I've been able to raise money for projects because I believe in them passionately. I can't raise a dime for something I don't believe in. It's just, you know, I can't do it. I don't know what to say.
But if
I believe in it, you can't shut me up.
So. Yeah, and I just wanted to say it goes back to the clip that we played from Walk the Line. I see a similar
scenario. Yeah, that's a beautiful clip. In fact, after I realized I have seen the film. I don't know why I thought I had seen it. I remember that scene very well. That was beautiful. Yeah.
Pamela, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that Paco is genetically incapable of raising money for something he doesn't believe in 150%.
And I just to give you a little more background, my upbringing was really different from Pamela's, but it's funny how two very different upbringings can lead to the same place. You know, I grew up in various Latin American countries because my father was a New York Times correspondent. So then he was bureau chief in Buenos Aires for a while, and then Brazil, and later Mexico. So this was my upbringing. And it happened to be, I grew up in the time of the dictators in Latin America. And I watched in my lifetime the power of human rights and law, and, you know, human rights law, coming from civil society, and it's just affected my whole life it wasn't in one moment like when Pamela saw To Kill a Mockingbird, but it was a process. And you know, we often at Q&As after our films, people say, gosh, it's so frustrating, you know, how can we stop these things from happening, and can, you know, are any of these perpetrators ever going to face justice and be accountable? And I have to remind people, you know, this happened in Latin America. When I was growing up, the idea that a dictator that was controlling a country, controlling all the weapons in the country, the tanks and the air force and, you know, and all the police force, that person could be put on trial and put in prison was just the talk of a madman, right? It was completely out of the question. And then I just saw how, and, you know, with great courage and great risk, and many, many human rights defenders died along the way and were imprisoned, but they prevailed, and the rule of law, you know, began to have its effect. And in Argentina, they locked up the generals, and in Peru, Fujimori just received a 25-year sentence. But these are long processes. Getting Fujimori on trial took 17 years. So that can be really frustrating, especially for a young person who doesn't see time and is stretched away as somebody who's, you know, who's my age and has, you know, being able to look back on all these years. But it's very satisfying to see that happen, if that's something that you've been trying to, you know, contribute your grain of sand, as Pamela was just saying, you know, putting in that grain of sand, and everybody putting in their grain of sand, you really can make a difference.
I want to go back, since you're mentioning Granito, and this idea that Pamela was talking about, how there's now like four movies that Skylight has planned to make, and the fourth one being about memory. So Pamela, when Skylight was formed, was that sort of like the strategic plan of the organization, or is it when Paco came in that became the clear mission of the organization, this quartet of films?
Oh, no, that really is something that developed as we were making both State of Fear and The Reckoning, as well as this most recent film. No, we only just started to really formulate that how is it that all these films are connected, and how do our ideas evolve from one film to another film to another film? So you can see each film individually, but it's better and richer if you see all of the films and understand how transitional justice evolves and becomes effective.
I think that's so fascinating because, you know, it speaks so to the creative process, and it's, you know, after you create something, you then start to see, okay, what is it really that I'm doing here? And now you see, like, you've seen beyond, and the same thing happens with writing. You write something down, and it gives you an idea that you didn't have because you wrote it down. So it's like the creation itself gives the creative inspiration for the things that come after it. And so it was really only after making The Reckoning that you guys had this more clear vision of this quartet.
Yeah, and I think that the new film that we're making, Granito, is really about, it's really about documentary filmmaking and questioning how and whether documentary filmmaking can make a difference. It's really meant to be for the next generation of human rights filmmakers. I hope that it will inspire them to think about doing this kind of work. Because it's a sequel to one of the very first films that we made called When the Mountains Tremble. And so in this new film, I've had to be very emotionally honest about, you know, what it takes to create a lifetime in human rights filmmaking. And that it, as Paco was saying, that it really does take a lifetime to make a small difference. But you have to be committed to making that difference and putting in the time, or the world will not become a better place.
The only thing I want to differ on that is I don't think it's a small difference. I think it's a lot of small pieces. But I think the difference between having a continent dominated by dictatorships and constant coup d'etats to a continent dominated by democracy is actually a huge, vast difference. But it was made with, you know, countless grains of sand.
It sounds, Paco, as though you've sort of been preparing for Skylight your entire life. Like, this is almost a job that you were meant for. I don't mean to take, you know, any credit away from Pam or, you know, other people who've built it up from the beginning.
Or Peter. I just want to mention that Peter, who's unfortunately not with us here on this call, but his father was one of the founders of the Center for Constitutional Rights and, you know, very huge figure in the civil rights movement and in fighting the McCarthy hearings. So Peter also grew up in a household that, you know, I think in a way destined him to the work that he does. You can come from so many different backgrounds and get to this, and I think everybody has their own story that's, you know, unique and fascinating stories and how the journey of their life unfolded.
And I just want to say, actually, it's funny that Mike put the question that way to you, Paco, because if I recall, in The Reckoning, Luis Moreno Ocampo says the exact same thing about how his job prosecuting the leaders of the junta prepared him for the role of chief prosecutor of the ICC, if I'm recalling correctly. He says something like that.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He realized that
he thought that was the biggest job he would ever do, and now he realized it was just preparing him for being the prosecutor of the ICC.
Yeah.
And I find myself constantly quoting Luis Moreno Ocampo's statements from the film. He has some really good moments there, like when he says, "We've seen it before," and he runs through all the previous genocides and what's happened. Speaking of accomplishments in human rights, I mean, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. Also, everybody thinks about Milosevic there and that he died before he was tried. But in fact, over 90 people 90 criminals have been convicted in that tribunal. It's no small number. I mean, it's really, I think it's a major accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. You're mentioning, quoting Ocampo from The Reckoning, and his, I'm sure you have all sorts of outtakes where he says millions of interesting things. But I think my favorite part is where he's getting off the radio interview. And
that's from Darfur Now.
I've seen that film, too. It's okay.
Yeah, we've seen it. The director's a great guy. I really like him. Huh?
He actually mentioned before the show how he keeps mixing them up in his mind. The Reckoning, Darfur Now.
I think it's because I watch them within like an hour of each other. I've been completely unable to differentiate which is which. But he sort of clicks his teeth in like a, I don't even know, like a final, maybe you have some insight on this, Paco, some sort of almost like Latin American frustration slash, it seems almost like a sigh.
I have the clip, actually, if you want me to play it.
Oh, you could play the clip. I'm not sure.
Okay, here's the clip. This is from Darfur Now, and this is, I've been calling him Louis. It's Louis. Louis.
Louis.
Okay. Well, here he is, and this is from Darfur Now, not The Reckoning, but yes, so this relates to the question that Mike just asked Paco.
As my office moves toward the presentation of evidence, it sends a signal to those who are considering committing further crimes that they cannot do so with impunity. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Yep.
Of course, it is needless for me to reemphasize again that the referral by the Security Council of this issue to the ICC has been very much politically motivated. The judiciary in Sudan is very well known for its integrity and competence, and we think that it is within the competence of our system that we will prosecute whoever is committing crimes in Darfur.
How many names are you going to present in your submissions?
No, I cannot give the names to you or to Sudan or to the Security Council. So the names and the evidence we present to the judges in February.
There's no way the Sudanese government is going to turn over these individuals for prosecution.
Will you offer the Khartoum a list of the people that you suspect to them?
Perhaps it's time to ignore Sudanese sovereignty.
No.
The media usually distorts a lot of things. So if you say this to them, they will interpret it differently. You have to be very careful.
Compared with any complex national investigation, I will tell you this is very fast. We did it in less than a year and a half. So I don't know what are the standards you're comparing to me, because really, it was a very fast investigation in a very impossible circumstances. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's the four journalists who tell me about why you are so slow. And where it's coming from, this idea we are slow.
For people who are covering this story, I think there's an emotional impatience. You know, people would like the people in Darfur to have an end to their suffering, and they've been waiting and watching. You know, it's like genocide in slow motion.
Yeah. We cannot fastify people. We have to learn this. We never will be fast enough, never, because what happened is a catastrophe. And then you pretend to do justice, and you are used to have a good justice system. You hope something different, but this is just so complicated and so big. Yeah.
There's a million different things going on in this clip. Many of them relate to things we've touched on in the show, as Paco was talking about the time issue as like a young person looking at it from the outside in. And the person Ocampo is talking to in that clip says genocide in slow motion is what it looks like, because the speed of the prosecution, just an incredible clip. I think my favorite part is where he's sort of clicking his teeth or whatever it is he's doing afterward. It's really humanizing for him. You know, here's this man who's the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and he's saying, I can't satisfy everyone. You know, I can't be a Superman. Love that clip.
Yeah.
Did you have any? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that's a very representative of Luis. He you know, for him, it's a passion. Actually, he's a true believer, and I think it probably has to do with his background in Argentina, which was, you know, it was just so huge what happened in Argentina. Both the size of the crime committed by the generals, and you know, 30,000 people disappeared, but and also then the response of civil society, you know, to restore democracy and justice in their society. It's an incredible
story. I also wanted to say that speaking of norm entrepreneurs, Luis Moreno Campo is right up there in the top 10. He attracts a huge amount of criticism, which is what the clip reminded me of. And the reason he attracts so much criticism is because everything that's happening right now at the International Criminal Court is really motivated by the Office of the Prosecutor. And he is trying to change the justice paradigm, the international justice paradigm in the world. And I think any time you try to change the norms, any time you try to really do something new and different, you're going to attract that kind of criticism. Luckily, he's a great first prosecutor because he can both absorb it and understand it, let it roll off his back, and just try to stick to doing his job as the first prosecutor of the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Can't even fathom the amount of commitment and things that it must take to do what he does on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah,
and
the stress. And when we've been showing The Reckoning around the world, people get up and say things like, he should be given the Nobel Peace Prize. He's one of the most heroic men working. And I think that in The Reckoning, we've created a story about the first six tumultuous years of the International Criminal Court, but also about how the court is like beleaguered and fighting for its life, so that at the end of the film, the audience really understands the difficulty, understands the problems, understands the criticism. It also is rooting for the success of the court.
Yeah, we're going to quickly switch to Alejandro soon, but I just wanted to say on that point, I remember it was a podcast that I heard Luis Moreno Ocampo saying something like when he was, because I'm pretty sure that nobody applied for that job, and he was asked to apply for it. And he was at Harvard at the time, and in this thing that I heard him say, he said something like his Harvard colleagues told him not to take it, that he would be, it would be a laughable position. But having said that, I'm going to switch it back to Mike and talk to Alejandro with 12 minutes remaining.
All right, maybe laughable for the commentary. Alejandro, I have to apologize. It seems as though Mom and Dad are stealing the spotlight. If you could comment on your involvement with Skylight, what is it that you do? How did you become involved?
Oops.
Are you there? Alejandro?
I should be here.
Oh, there you are.
We hear you now. We hear you.
Much better.
Okay. I got clicked off there.
Okay. We got you back.
I became involved in Skylight, well, I guess ever since Paco and Pam got married, I was involved in Skylight just by virtue of sitting at the dinner table every night and sort of absorbing their work and the things that they were doing. At the time, I moved to New York sort of in my last 2 years of high school. And it was funny. I understood what they did and I got it, but where I was in my life and in high school, I had no desire to do anything in the documentary field whatsoever. But over time and, you know, over experience of the work that they were doing, the types of things that they were getting done with their work, I became very intrigued and sort of began to develop a passion for human rights. But as a process, it took a while for me to wrap my head around it.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I started to work as an intern for TV companies because Paco and Pam had connections there and it gave me something to do in the summertime. And so I started to work in television. But I worked in television for a long time without working with Pam and Paco until basically 2005, I don't think. Right, Pat?
Yeah, time? Exactly. Yes.
So that's how I slowly got involved. But technically what we're doing now with ID Essential and that involvement happened because Pam and Paco got into a program called BAVAC Producers Institute. And they took a project, they took The Reckoning to this thing called the Producers Institute where they incubate ideas for outreach that are attached to human rights films or films that have sort of social documentary themes involved in them. And Paco asked me to get involved because of my love of technology. I'm not sure how I got involved. Paco, did you ask me or did I want to get involved?
I asked you.
I needed to
take two people with me for my team, and I asked you because of your knowledge of technology, and then our other team member, Michael Shamoon, who is a friend of Alejandro's as well, who is a great code writer. So we needed somebody who could write code, and I needed somebody who could work on design, which is Alejandro, and also the video editing and things like that. So that was our team, and we developed IJ Central.
Yeah, and can you talk about what IJ Central is, Alejandro?
IJ Central, in the very beginning, was a way to start to gather or build an idea around a social movement for awareness and education about the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
When I got involved in that project with Paco and Pam, their film The Reckoning, I had no idea. I'd never heard of the ICC before in my life, and sort of it struck me as a really profound idea to have this, you know, sort of core with universal jurisdiction, and you know, it was a very lofty goal, and it didn't occur to me, and I became very intrigued with it. So ID Central was a way to sort of build an idea around the court, not as a sort of platform to praise the court constantly, but just sort of to sort of have a way to gather resources and information about the court and give people sort of a one-stop shop to get all information that people are talking about via the ICC. And we've been doing that for 2 years now in January, and we're gearing up to try to sort of change ID Central a bit and sort of refocus its perspective to become even more socially involved with its constituents.
Right, build community around it.
Yeah, and the website address is ijcentral.org, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. We have a feature there called Ask the Prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
where people can ask questions directly to the prosecutor. I mean, the prosecutor asked us, basically if we wanted to, have his input. He gives weekly briefings now. We post them there, and he answers questions on video. You can see it all at IJ Central.
Mm-hmm. It's a great website. Do check it out. And I think there may be a link to it on our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. We do have a caller on the line, and we have 6 minutes remaining. How do you guys feel about taking a call?
Fantastic.
Sure.
Bring it.
Yeah.
All right. So... caller, 718 area code, you are on Ethics Talk. Do you have a question for any of the members of Skylight?
Well, actually, this is Peter Canoy, another member of Skylight Pictures, just calling in to give a shout-out to my great partners who are representing on the show. I think it's a great, great show, and sounds like you're going to have a wonderful screening out there in Michigan.
I'm looking forward to it.
So, Peter, I'm so glad you came on the line. Have you been listening to the show?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I learned all about you and Pam that I never knew before.
Get out of here.
Well, Peter, we apologize for not having you on, but as it is with Ethics Talk, our first show is always the beginning of a conversation, and if it's okay with everybody else, and Alejandro, I mean... And once again, it always happens at the end of the show. We sort of, we don't have enough time to do everything we can.
No, I just wanted to give a shout out to you all. And you know, the more people that get involved with trying to figure out how they can contribute in their particular walk of life to creating something better for a larger community, you know, that's what really pushes things forward. So I think I had never heard about the Ethics Talk, you know, webcast before, but it's just a wonderful thing. And you know, I wish you a lot of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, well,
anything else you want to say? Sorry.
Yeah, I want to say something really quickly. I think, speaking of, you know, they've been making films for 30 years and how the evolution of the films have become, you know, more of a mindset of process and, you know, it was a trilogy, now they're making a quartet, and every film sort of changes perspective of where they're going from there. I think what we talk a lot about now, which I find really interesting and why I've really become more and more involved with Skylight, because we're going to be doing other projects, is this idea that films aren't just films anymore. With the internet and the sort of, you know, changes in technology and outreach, films are really becoming their ideas. And it's the idea that you want to get across, and a film is a part of that idea. A website is a part of that idea. An outreach campaign is another part of that idea. And going from becoming a traditional film shop that makes documentaries only, and now we're evolving into sort of a production company that's producing ideas and ways of sort of delivering those ideas to the public and getting messages across, is sort of a new thing, and it's very exciting, I think.
Yeah, and again, going back to this term norm entrepreneur, and Alejandra, if I may, there is actually a video of you. I think it's on YouTube. And it's with you and Paco at the Bay Area something another, where you're talking about showing Second Life, or the Reckoning and Second Life. And there's actually you being actually expressing pessimism about technology. Do you recall that conversation? It was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, actually, I kind of want to get rid of my cell phone, but I know I can't right now. But I'm always very skeptical about technology. You know, I think people overuse it sometimes. And
right.
I'm always trying to think about how to whittle it down to just sort of its core good.
But I think it's interesting.
You don't need to overdo it.
Yeah, at the same time that you're, you know, praising Skylight for evolving into this idea machine, which is using the power of social media and the internet through IJ Central, for example, you know, at the same time you're also mindful of the danger of technology, and I think that makes you an ideal person to be doing what you're doing with Skylight.
Yeah, we really have a combination of traditional storytelling and traditional filmmaking with using media across multiple digital platforms to make a difference. So the films that we make are really just a flagship for a whole media menu of other things, from very big to very small, that people can use and get involved with.
Mm-hmm. And now you have a little audio file from Ethics Talk to
add. There you go.
To add to that. So
far, yeah. Our events for, speaking of the coming showing here at Central, screening, that is, The Reckoning, so far our events have been standing room only. And we're hoping that we can continue to contribute to the awareness you seek.
Fantastic.
Great.
Yeah, hopefully these events will be just packed.
And they will be archived, so if we're no longer existing and servers are, and hopefully people who walk the earth after us will be able to watch and listen.
Servers can share files with other servers, and we don't need to be in the picture anymore.
There you go. All right, well, you've been listening to Ethics Talk, and we've been talking with people from Skylight Pictures, Pamela Yates, Paco Tonek, and Alejandro de Onis. EthicsTalk.cmisha.edu and HumanRightsMonth.com to watch, actually, Paco's visit live or archived or whenever you get a chance. So thank you all.
And we'd also like to thank Peter Canoy, obviously, for taking time out of his busy schedule to call in, and we're so thankful to have these guests. You know, they're incredibly busy people doing so much, and We've been honored to talk with them. We hope you're just as honored to listen to them.
And hopefully, I mean, if it fits in with your guys' schedule sometime to do another show, I know I certainly have a lot of questions and perhaps going, you know, into stuff about the ICC and just a few questions about, I don't know, passions and stuff. And I do have some big-time questions, so let's just leave it at
that. All right.
All right, let's continue the conversation.
Continue the conversation, yes. It's really been
a
pleasure.
Great. Well, you guys have a good evening, and Paco, we'll see you soon.
See you tomorrow in Michigan.
Yep. All righty.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.